From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I hope you'll take advantage of that. In fact, I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, you know how grateful we are for that gift. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. It's not something he does every year, but our producer, Ray Kirstein, is taking this week off. So we're bringing you some important interviews from past shows that are as relevant today as they were when we first brought them to you. So here's what's coming up on this Best of State of Belief Radio. As we bemoan the politicization of our federal courts under this administration, perhaps it's more important than ever to remember the impact judges, particularly when religion is involved, can play in our lives. Last week marked the 93rd anniversary of the infamous Scopes Monkey Trial verdict, and we'll revisit my 2008 interview with Carl Gilbertson, author of Saving Darwin, How to Be a Christian and Believe in Evolution. When I spoke with Nate Phelps, survivor of the notorious Westboro Baptist Church hate cult and son of founder Fred Phelps, it was 2014. Nate was fundraising for a documentary film of his painful story in a Kickstarter campaign that sadly didn't succeed. Nate has continued to be a sought-after public speaker and a role model of resilience and conscientious living. Since then, the project's name has changed from Not My Father's Son to Not My Father's Child. The project had a successful fundraiser last year, and production has resumed. Nate's story is both painful and inspiring, and I've been waiting for the right moment to put it back on the air. This is that moment. But first, it was exactly 50 years ago that Pope Paul VI issued an encyclical titled Humanae Vitae, Latin for of human life. In the United States, it crystallized the role of a church that had once been feared as an outside political force in this country as a key definer of our national morality. Journalist Patricia Miller published a book in 2014 titled Good Catholics, The Battle Over Abortion in the Catholic Church, which also addresses the amazing political struggle around birth control within the Vatican. On this anniversary, we'll bring you an interview with Patty Miller that we first aired when the book was published.
I was just really struck by how much abortion discourse has come to dominate the life of the Catholic Church. That just wasn't the way it was 20 or 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. You could happily go to church for years and participate in parish activities and honestly never hear the word abortion mentioned. It was not the marker of what made a good Catholic. And it seems like nowadays that's become really the demarcation between what is a good Catholic and not a good Catholic is someone adhering to a very strict anti-abortion position. I was curious as how that came to be.
The disconnect between how most people think doctrine is formed and how it sometimes is actually formed is nothing less than breathtaking. And then that doctrine makes its way into the secular world to radically influence public policy. I wish you would talk briefly about the way the development of the pill was handled by the Catholic Church.
It's a fascinating story, and I guess I would just preface it by saying it shouldn't surprise anyone that the development of Catholic doctrine, like so many other things, is at the end of the day fundamentally political. It often serves the needs of the people who are in power at the Vatican at that moment. There was a movement in the 60s to approve birth control. It was very consistent with Catholic doctrine. A very famous judge and author, Noonan, wrote a book called Contraception and really laid out all the reasons that Catholic doctrine did not say you couldn't use contraception. It was kind of a hodgepodge of myth and theology and folk beliefs and long-term old school prohibitions against using contraception because there was an interest in growing the population back in the days when there weren't a lot of people around. And he said, you know, there's really no reason we can't change that. A lot of theologians believed that the doctrine could be changed, that it was really based on a very outmoded idea of marriage, which was that marriage was primarily for procreation, and that in the modern world, the church had already recognized that marriage was both for procreation and also for companionship and for the completion of the person within the relationship of marriage. And so they said, you know, there's no reason we can't change this because we've already recognized when we said you could use natural family planning, which is the rhythm method, that Catholics could limit their family size. So why not just change the doctrine? It was really just changing the method that was allowable, not whether family planning itself was allowable. Perfectly logical approach to evolving a doctrine. It was really an evolution of a doctrine. The reason that didn't happen was political. There was a small faction within the church that felt very strongly that the church's authority on these issues was tied to not being seen as wrong on the issue ever. And there was really a underlying belief that to give women the right to decide when and if they got pregnant was really going to change the way the church viewed women. They viewed women still as primarily a mother and defined by their biological function. And when they really looked at what that change in contraception doctrine would mean to that idea of women, they backed down and they did not change it. It was a very political decision at the end of the day.
And where did the pressure come from for the decision going the way it did?
The belief is that there was a small group of thinkers within the Vatican, about four bishops who famously wrote a minority report to the mainstream report. Interestingly enough, the Pope's own commission on birth control said the doctrine should be changed. It was a minority report written by four dissenting theologian priests that really held sway over a much larger group of both bishops and lay people who did decide the doctrine should be changed.
So it didn't just come down from heaven.
It did not come down from heaven. It came from actual humans.
There's an amazing quotation that you attribute to a theologian of the period who asked, what would happen to the millions we've sent to hell for using contraception if the teaching were suddenly changed? Now, was that theology or was that politics?
That was politics, and I think that was human pride. It was the sense that if we admitted we were wrong, we would look foolish. And so, therefore, we must hold on to a incorrect belief in the face of all the overwhelming evidence that it is, in fact, incorrect. And you can see a lot of what's happened in the Catholic Church ever since then has been trying to cover that up and explain that and paper that over. And that's why there's, I think, so much instability in the church doctrine around all the sexuality-related issues, because that doctrine was so fundamentally flawed.
Patty, I don't mean to sound cynical here, because I have appreciation for the Catholic Church, but I've read the formative theologians of the Catholic Church, the ancient ones, and when you read Augustine and Aquinas and those people, I have to say they were so screwed up on sexuality that they couldn't have done anything else but put the church in a confused situation.
That's very true. And they were even more screwed up, unfortunately, on women, because they saw women as really a lesser version of men. As I think it was Augustine who called women a misbegotten creature. They saw women as kind of poorly formed men, as half-formed men. So anything that had to do with woman and sex, is just kind of polluted from the get-go by that understanding. And that's exactly what the modern theologians were trying to look at when they suggested revising the birth control doctrine, because they said our understanding of woman has evolved. So let's look at that doctrine in light of how we view woman nowadays. And when that didn't happen, it unfortunately kept a lot of those historical undertones about women and sex in the Catholic doctrine that should have been excavated right about 1968.
When you look at the endless lawsuits over the contraception coverage mandate today, how much difference do you think it would make if this history was more widely known?
People would have laughed the bishops and their allies right out of the courts when they came forward with these lawsuits, because not only do most Catholics use contraception, but the doctrine is so theologically unsound and was so close to being changed that I really think they would have no viability on this issue if this was better known.
What about abortion in church history?
Abortion, too, has a very interesting history where it was viewed at different times in different ways. The church has always taught that abortion is a sin, but the Catholic Church did not teach until very recently that abortion was murder. Much like society in general, the Catholic Church recognized that the human fetus gains value as the pregnancy progresses. Early abortion was not considered murder. Much as in common law in this country and in other countries, abortion before a fetus had what they used to call quickened, which was about the fourth or fifth month when the woman could feel the fetus moving, that was not considered murder. That was considered before the fetus was a definable human being separate from the mother, and that was treated separately than murder. It was considered serious and in some cases a sin, but there was much more leeway for abortion than people think of in Catholic theology.
What were the battles that took place around that?
The biggest battle really has been this idea that this idea even existed. Pro-choice Catholics, pro-choice theologians, pro-choice priests and nuns, all of which there have been, have argued that this history of understanding Catholic theology on abortion needs to be better understood to have discussions about things, for instance, if abortion should be allowed in cases of rape or incest or fetal deformity, which there's widespread support for allowing abortion in those instances. So the fact that these discussions have even occurred in church history has been somewhat suppressed. The Catholics who have said either that you can talk about abortion or that if you are a Catholic in public life, if you are a Catholic politician and want to vote in ways that represent all your constituents, not just your Catholic constituents, since no one who is a politician in America just has Catholic constituents, that they're not allowed to do that. There's been huge battles over the issue of pro-choice Catholic politicians being able to represent the pro-choice point of view in their political life, even if they hold a view in their private life that is more close to Catholic doctrine.
Mm-hmm. When I grew up in the evangelical tradition, Catholics were only questionably Christian. And yet the evangelical churches have taken the hardline Catholic doctrine and made that their doctrine.
I think it's a very fascinating development of the past, especially 20 years. We just recently hit the 20th anniversary of a very landmark declaration called Catholic and Evangelicals Together, where the evangelicals agreed to set aside their historic taste of Catholicism to team up with conservative Catholics on the life issues. Mm-hmm. And that's when you really begin to see this very hardcore Catholic doctrine about abortion, but increasingly about contraception also, which evangelicals historically never had really had objections to contraception one way or the other. They tended to be at least agnostic about the issue. One of my contentions of my book is this far-right Catholic distaste for contraception has really infected the Christian right in some ways as well.
Yeah. Well, you were already smart when you started writing this book, so I want to ask you, what surprised you the most while you were working on the book?
Really, what surprised me the most was the stories of the people that I encountered, especially the women who very bravely in the 60s came out publicly and said, I use birth control, I believe a good Catholic can have an abortion or can support abortion rights in public life. These women were some of the earliest Catholic theologian women. They were very cutting edge for their era, and a lot of them didn't get a lot of public acclaim at the time. Many of them were unable to find careers in theology because they were women, but they waged a very lonely fight because they felt it was right that women should make their voice heard in the Catholic Church. I was surprised to learn how many women there were like that, say, in the 60s and 70s, and how little known they are nowadays because they were kind of successfully stifled in some ways by the church, but of course their ideas have really lived on in the pro-choice Catholic doctrine that exists today.
If you had your way, when a reader finishes reading that book, what do you want them to feel?
I would like them to feel that the Catholic history on sex and sexuality is much richer than most people realize, that the theology and the doctrine that has been kind of sold, especially in the past 20 years, it's kind of a thin gruel, and there's a much richer soup of thought and people and ideas that is much more in line with the democratic tradition. Catholics have always taken great pride in, you know, many from immigrant populations coming to this country and participating in this democracy, and I think we've seen a real narrowing of those views, especially when it comes to abortion and contraception. And I think Catholics should be proud of the richness of that history and not ashamed to embrace that.
Patricia Miller is the author of Good Catholics, The Battle Over Abortion in the Catholic Church.
That's what the good book says. That's what the good book says. And nothing's going to hurt you if your living is right. That's what the good book says.
There's lots more of the highlight show coming right up. We'll rewind to 2008 to hear again my conversation with Carl Giberson, author of Saving Darwin, How to Be a Christian and Believe in Evolution. And up next, Nate Phelps, son of the late Fred Phelps, founder of the Westboro Baptist Church. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to the Best of State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance.
David was smaller, no bigger than me. He fought old Goliath, who was 8'3".
It was spellbinding to hear the experiences of Westboro Baptist Church survivor Nate Phelps, son of the hate cult's founder, Fred Phelps, when he joined me on this show 4 years ago. As Nate continues to travel and speak widely, as well as work on a documentary of his story that's now titled Not My Father's Child, here's part of that conversation.
First of all, I think it is a misdiagnosis if people think that the Westboro Baptist Church is that far from a lot of other religious groups in the United States. I think that the fact that they were so in-your-face about it is off-putting, but there are a lot of people out there who secretly hold basically the exact same ideas that they do.
Yeah,
and that translates to a rigidness and an intolerance in the life of a child growing up in an environment like that that is profoundly destructive.
What was it like growing up in the Westboro Baptist Church?
First thing you have to understand is the nature of my father. And he wasn't just this preacher who was espousing a fundamentalist Calvinist ideology. He was a driven man. He was a intelligent man. And he was extreme in everything he did. He was very black and white. So when you start taking some of these Bible verses and interpreting them black and white, you start seeing behavior patterns come out, such as his willingness to use physical violence to maintain order in the house. So he also took from the Bible that he had the right and the authority and the responsibility to keep his wife in subjection. So he was violent towards her physically and verbally. And that was the nature of the environment we grew up in, was this extreme, critical, often enough violent that it kept everyone on their toes. And that's an aspect of it that most people don't understand is you didn't have to have violence every day. You just had to have an environment where you just never knew. It was unpredictable when he was going to explode and that was going to spew out to everybody in that environment. So we were constantly afraid. I became a master at reading the environment everywhere I went to see if I was in danger. And I suspect that that's a common thread throughout my siblings, but I don't know that for all of them because I haven't talked to them for 35 years.
Nate, did you see that first in the church or at home?
There was no real distinction between the two. Uh-huh. We lived in the building that the church was in. Huh. There were no boundaries. So he would discipline us as quickly from the pulpit as he did in our private lives. Uh-huh. He would talk about the conduct of the children or his wife or any other member of, the other few members of the church in front of the rest of the congregation. So it was all the same to me.
Hmm. So were the members of the church in as much fear as you and the other members of the family?
There were two other families that were going there.
I see.
They certainly were in fear of whether they were going to violate one of his ideas about proper conduct.
Mm-hmm.
He had absolute power in that situation, even though he called a couple of the older men elders. They really didn't have any say or control in the situation. So there had to be some level of fear there. I don't think there was fear of physical violence amongst them, but certainly with the rest of my family there was.
So the physical violence was kept within the family, not within the congregation?
Yes and no. I tell the story of why my older brother ended up leaving, because his girlfriend at the time came in for church service one Sunday evening, and my father was upstairs beating my older sister, and the other families were already there, and we were all milling around in the church auditorium waiting for that to finish so church service would start. So they knew it was going on.
Mm.
They just didn't necessarily fear it for themselves.
Yeah. When did you first realize that your life was different from the lives of other kids and that your church was different from other churches?
That's a good question. There's a lot of pieces that play into that. I mean, we grew up with the idea that we were supposed to be different and that difference made us better.
Mm-hmm.
That was the message we were taught. We basically recognized that as being the truth until, we had the capacity to think for ourselves. So I would say that very early on, there was that knowledge that we were different from everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
But we saw it as a positive thing, growing up in that situation, that put us in a better position than the rest of the world.
Were the periods of anger from your father evoked by behavior or by belief or by both?
It was often a combination of things, and it led to overreactions because he would see the conduct of a child that, I raised four of my own kids, and I'm aware of what kids are capable of.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm aware of what I did. And instead of it being discipline that matched the conduct, he always added so much into it that this was a reflection on the church, and it took on an eternal tone to it, that this misconduct of a 5 or 6 year old kid was something that was going to reverberate down the halls of eternity, and it suggested some satanic influence in our lives and that kind of thing. So the reaction was extreme, and the rhetoric was extreme.
Yeah.
And you may realize, and most folks should realize, the physical part of it, that eventually goes away. It's the message that you heard over and over, and the tone in which you heard it. That's what stays with you, and that's where the real destruction comes from.
Did you have questions that you wanted to ask but didn't ask, or could you ask questions at all?
No, you couldn't ask. And I do recall, as I moved into my teenage years, a lot of questions coming up. But the problem was that if you showed any inclination to challenge or to do anything other than just accept and embrace wholeheartedly everything that was put out there, it could lead to, at the very least, a lot of verbal the abuse so much as challenges, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, as a child, it's very difficult for you to separate out that, you know, this is a process of communicating versus this can turn into a violent situation.
Yeah.
Just never knew when it was going to slip over, right?
Yeah. My understanding is that, Nate, you left the church before the notorious pickets began. So during those earlier years, what was the focus of the church's teachings?
Well, it was very similar to what it is today. I would say that some of the ideas that they hold more firmly today have been refined, but fundamentally the message and the teaching is identical to what I grew up with.
Hmm.
A lot of the language that you hear my siblings using on the picket lines, it's, you know, they're parroting my father. It's stuff that I heard 30 years ago.
Do you remember when you said, I can't take this anymore, I got to get away from here?
Well, I know that I felt that way for a very long time going into my teenage years, but it never occurred to me that the possibility existed because none of my siblings had managed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I watched my oldest sister try when she was 17, and he literally physically pulled her back home, and the rest of the time that she was there before she turned 18, there was a lot of violence. So as much as you wanted it, it wasn't necessarily considered seriously. And then my older brother Mark left. Mm-hmm. And I was, I think, nearly 16 years old when that happened, and that was when the idea kind of coalesced and solidified in my mind that, yeah, I can do this.
What happened between when you left home and how you became an activist?
I left believing everything that my father taught me. So I left believing that I was going to die probably around the year 2000 when Christ returned, and I was going to go to hell.
Yeah,
that was the mindset that I had when I left. I just had to get out of there because of the violence. I avoided religion and the church like the plague for about 5 years, and then I met a gal, and we ended up getting married and started having kids. That's when I started returning to a church and joined an evangelical free church.
Mm-hmm.
But throughout that entire process, I was still asking a lot of questions. A lot of it didn't make sense to me. It wasn't solving my life issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started deliberately challenging the leaders of the church in the area that I was living in, Southern California, and ended up going through a divorce, and I moved to Canada, and finally in 2004, I think, was the first time I ever actually read something about the question of religion that hadn't been written by a Christian. Mm-hmm. It hadn't been written specifically to bolster that that idea, right?
Yeah.
And that's when I started going down the path of questioning it all and they say, losing my religion.
When did you get rid of the fear? Or have you?
When I let go of the idea of God is when the burden fell off.
Yeah.
And it has been a dramatic experience in the last, I'd say, 7 years. It hasn't been a slow process like so much of the path that I was on.
Yeah.
It's suddenly, there's tremendous relief and a strong movement towards more joy in my life because I'm confident now of the nature of the world and there's nothing to fear anymore.
You're hearing a 2014 interview I conducted with Nate Phelps, son of the late founder of the Westboro Baptist Church, Fred Phelps. Was it a difficult decision to agree to do a full-length documentary about your life?
I'll be honest with you. I think that the difficulty was the decision I made about 5 years ago when I was confronted with the opportunity to actually start speaking publicly about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to confront a lot of the fear that I still had, a lot of the guilt. So I went through a deliberate process then before I started speaking and made up my mind that I was prepared to deal with whatever. So since then, no, this is what I decided that I was going to do. One of the decisions I made was, to the best of my ability, I was going to be as transparent and as honest as I could be, even about the ugly stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly, in the process, raises up a lot of ugliness, a lot of emotions.
Sure.
But I'm more than prepared and willing to do that right now.
I know that you have this desire to work with victims of religious abuse. When you look back, was there anything that could have been done outside your family that would have helped you and your brothers and sisters?
What a great question. I honestly don't think there was, because you have to look at the time we were growing up. This was in the 60s and the 70s. We think that Christianity has a stronghold on America now. Go back to that period.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason why my father was able to be that way for so long, because he lived in an environment where that was accepted.
Yeah.
Even though at one point there was charges brought against him for child abuse, eventually those even were dropped because he was a preacher. He was a man of the cloth.
Yeah.
Folks just gave them more credit.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then what does that help look like? If the state gets involved, are they going to get involved taking 13 kids away?
Yeah.
Or are they going to turn their head? And is my mom able to take care of 13 kids on her own? That wasn't real life, so there wasn't anything that could be done.
Yeah. Do you still have relationships with family members who have left the Westboro Baptist Church?
I do. In fact, I worked for like 25 years with my older brother, Mark.
I see.
And my younger sister, who has left for good, is actually still living in Topeka, and her and I have a good relationship.
Do you see a pattern in members who have left, or were your experiences unique?
Well, the younger generation, I mean, Mark certainly had very similar experiences that I did, maybe not to the extent I did. And Dortha was, you know, she was one of the younger ones, so things seemed to have started, I guess he got tired at some point, so it wasn't so profound. But she still has a lot of emotional harm because of the issue of women being second-class citizens
mm-hmm.
in that religious environment, right? That was a big part of growing up there, too. But the younger generation, they've got a different set of issues because they didn't experience the violence like we did.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of my nieces and nephews, you know, they still have the theology. They still have the belief that because they left there, they're going to spend eternity suffering for it.
Hmm. You obviously were the victim of a manipulation of religion to control or try to control your life. We're seeing a lot of manipulation of religion from some religious communities today, both in the political world and in the religious world. I'd just be interested in what comment you have on the manipulation of religion that you saw in your own life.
Well, I'm not sure how best to answer that question. When my family first started this campaign and suddenly there were reporters wanting to talk to me about it and there was stories out there, the general consensus was that this was a cult and these guys were not true Christians
mm-hmm.
and they were brainwashed and all that kind of language that you hear. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking when I first heard, that's just not true. This isn't like David Koresh or Jim Jones. This mm-hmm. This is what's in the Bible.
Yeah.
And perhaps because I was in the position I was in, I don't know, but I hold to the idea that my father was absolutely honest in what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't change my mind for a moment that the effect was
mm-hmm.
manipulative and that the harm was profound and for a lifetime.
Yeah.
But I don't know about the when we talk about manipulation,
what's
the road to hell is paved with good intentions,
yeah,
right? I think he had good intentions.
You're making a great point. You really are.
So I can't, when I look at what goes on out there with some of these politicians and some of the messages and programs that are out there as far as the moral majority or
yeah.
their predecessors,
right.
I don't know. It sure feels like manipulation to me as an adult looking
yeah.
at it, right?
Right. What is your understanding of what happened within the church during your father's illness and then since his passing?
As long as it's clear that I can only tell you what I heard, so this is definitely hearsay.
I understand.
I'll tell you that. I had a conversation, or actually I got a message from one of my nieces who said that one of Shirley's children had left like 2 weeks prior, and that he came out with the story that Fred had been in a battle with the Board of Elders, which, as I understand, there are eight of the men now are the Board of Elders on for that church, that they voted him out. Now, I have heard that they voted him out because he was advocating for a kinder approach, and I have also heard that they voted him out because it was basically a power struggle.
Yeah,
I don't know. I know that they physically removed him from, because, like I said, we grew up, we lived in that building. He lived in that church building for 55 years or longer.
Goodness.
And they moved him out of there, and they moved him into another house, and they had people watching him because they were afraid of his reaction.
Yeah.
And that he quit eating. He didn't want to go on living, apparently.
Yeah.
And that that is what quickly led him to hospice care.
Well, Nate, I know that this discussion, certainly for anyone that pays attention, makes it even more important for the documentary that you're going to do that's Call Now, Not My Father's Son. You've started this Kickstarter campaign to fund the production of the documentary, and that ends on July the 7th. We want to tell our listeners how they could make a contribution to see that this campaign gets the funding it needs to see the documentary made. So will you say just a word or two about that and how people can send money to you for that purpose?
Yeah, the best way to do it is to, if you get on Google and just Google the words Kickstarter and Not My Father's Son, and it'll send you straight to that page. And then there's you have the opportunity to give a contribution. And along the right side of that web page is a list of gifts that are given based on the amount of the contribution.
Yeah.
And we are also working on coming up with maybe a couple more options in that category as well. So there's a lot of nice stuff that people can get and still provide resources for us getting the filming done.
And you need about $55,000 in all.
Yep.
So we're going to also link to that page from our website. One last question.
Sure.
For someone who watches Not My Father's Son after it's made, what do you hope will be the result of someone seeing it?
The approach I've taken over the years is I believe that if you can reach people's hearts, but that's the first step in getting them to change their mind, especially on some of these tough, knotty issues that people hold on to dearly. And what I'm hoping will happen is that people will see the world of religion and the impact that religion has, not only on the individuals growing up in an extreme environment like that, but on the ideas that exist out there as a result of religion.
Yes.
That caused so much harm in other areas. Specifically, one of the areas I focus on is the LGBT community.
Sure. Well, Nate, I want you to know that I am a person who embraces religion and tries to practice it, and I could not be sorrier than I am right now in hearing the way in which you experienced religion and the terrible, terrible consequences of that in your life. Nate Phelps, my friends, was raised in the Westboro Baptist Church that was started by his late father, the Reverend Fred Phelps, Sr. The Kickstarter campaign is underway to make a documentary of his experience and of that experience in the church. Nate, I really appreciate your honesty, your candor, and I think that the interview itself will be of benefit to a lot of people because a lot of people have been hurt by religion. And thank you for talking about it.
I appreciate the opportunity, sir.
The courts and faith are colliding in this country in a way that may seem unprecedented. But there have been moments in our history that should at least serve as a warning. July of 1925 was one such moment as a federal court ruled in what has become known as the Scopes Monkey Trial. In 2008, I spoke with Carl Giberson, author of Saving Darwin, How to Be a Christian and Believe in Evolution. More than 80 years ago this week, the now infamous Scopes Trial, also known as the Monkey Trial, wrapped up its eight-day-long hearing in Tennessee. Amidst press coverage and heated commentary, the likes of which few court proceedings had seen up to that point. At question in the case, as most of you already know, was whether evolution was and should be taught in public schools. When the trial ended in June of 1925, the plaintiff, John Scopes, was found guilty, having violated the Butler Act, a Tennessee law that forbade the teaching of evolution in public schools. Scopes' guilty verdict was overturned on a technicality, but the Butler Act remained on the books until well into the 1960s. The principle, by the way, still pervades many state legislatures. Today, the battle between evolutionists and creationists continues to rage, as many fundamentalist religious activists lobby to oust evolution from public schools in favor of the scientifically questionable, to say the least, intelligent design theory. They claim that belief in evolution, an accepted scientific theory, somehow denies a belief in God. Not true, says my next guest. Carl Giberson is a professor of physics at Eastern Nazarene College and director of the Forum in Faith and Science at Gordon College. Professor Giberson was raised a fundamentalist and admits he once counted himself a member of the anti-Darwin camp. But today he's managed to wholeheartedly support and teach evolution and still remain devoutly religious. He's also the author of a new book, Saving Darwin, How to Be Christian and Believe in Evolution. Carl Giberson joins me now by phone. Carl, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Now, you disagree with biblical literalists who tout creationism and disregard any science behind evolution. But you also don't agree with scientists who say that science can explain away a belief in God. How do you describe your own relationship between science and religion?
Well, in a lot of ways, I feel like the older I get, the less I know about either science or religion. I mean, of course, you learn more, but the more you learn, the more you realize that you don't know. And I've come to have a great appreciation for the limitations, both of science to be able to make general statements about all of reality, and the limitations of religion to speak with such certainties about the content of its belief.
Now, I've seen this statistic before, and you quoted in your book as well, that more than half of our country believes that God created humans in their present form, which is, of course, a complete denial of evolution. As a physicist and as a science teacher, how does that make you feel?
Well, as a physicist, it makes me feel very frustrated that we can have so much scientific advance in the 20th century and have so many people who are completely oblivious to it. It's kind of amazing to think that half the population of the United States can be that disconnected from scientific progress. As a teacher, it makes me just realize that on the teaching end of things, there's two places where we have to focus attention. We've got to pay more attention to what we teach people in Sunday school. A lot of churches, including the one that I go to, that are not biblically literalist in their approach to the scriptures, they still teach little children as if they were literalists. And children acquire these beliefs about Noah and his ark and Adam and Eve and so on as preschoolers, and then they don't ever really get a chance to critically re-examine those later. And then when we get to college, these kids have crises of faith when they discover that their science professors think these stories have been completely repudiated by scientific advance and so on, and it can sometimes be quite traumatic.
You use the book to dispel certain anti-Darwin myths propagated by creationists. One was that Darwin began his research out of a desire to destroy a belief in God, that he was even motivated by Satan. What's your response to that argument?
Well, those things are just crazy. I mean, Darwin's not somebody who lives 3,000 years ago that we have to reconstruct through little tiny snippets and anecdotes. I mean, Darwin is someone who lived in the 19th century. History was a real live discipline then. We have letters and correspondence that are in existence that we can study, and it's very easy to recreate the path that Darwin took from being a young man who gets on the Beagle to travel around the earth with a well-read copy of the Bible under his arm and so on, and then the elder Darwin who had become something of an agnostic and was very disillusioned with his childhood faith. And I mean, we know how that trajectory happened, and we know that that Darwin's faith journey was one that troubled him greatly, and there was no sense of eagerness as he went about developing his theory. I mean, he discovered sort of to his dismay that he couldn't reconcile his discoveries with his belief. His wife was a very devout Christian till the end of her life, and Darwin was dismayed by the wedge that his science drove between him and his beloved wife Emma. So these ideas that there's some kind of a conspiracy on Darwin's part to attack religion, I mean, this, you can't possibly read even one biography of Darwin and come away with that conclusion. It just holds up. Just holds no water when you look at it closely. It's a preposterous claim.
Carl Giberson is a professor of physics at Eastern Nazarene College and director of the Forum in Faith and Science at Gordon College. He's also the author of a new book, Saving Darwin, How to Be Christian and Believe in Evolution. Professor Giberson, this really has been enjoyable. Thanks for speaking with me on State of Belief.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And engage in the discussion. We need to hear from you. Our producer is Ray Kirstein, who I hope is getting some rest this week. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.